I'm John Batchelor with Michelle Paradis. His new book is The Light of Battle, about Ike. And he is now end of February 1944. The gathering storm called Overlord. The masters of the battle, the captains, battle captains, are gathered round him having an argument that will continue right up to the moment of the contact with the Germans. It has to do with something called Operation Anvil and something to do with the air plan, point blank. These now seem faded into history, but Michelle's done us the favor of bringing them forward. What were they talking about at all these meetings? They were arguing. That's what they were doing.
That's right.
Let's start with Operation Anvil. What was it, and why did it bedevil Eisenhower? What were the British thinking?
Sure. So, you know, the original plan was not just to invade France from the north across Normandy, as we know, but to actually do essentially a continental pincer maneuver with an invasion of Normandy in the north and then an invasion of the French Riviera in the south. And Roosevelt loved this idea for a lot of important reasons that I get that are easy to overlook in hindsight, not the least being Roosevelt needed to or felt he needed to impress the Russians. You know, the United States was very much an unproven world power, really up until D-Day. And when, you know, Roosevelt meets Stalin for the first time at the end of 1943, right around within the middle of the Cairo conference, they all fly to Tehran for the first big meeting between Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin. You know, Roosevelt is very keen to present the United States as not just the second fiddle to the British Empire, but really a power unto itself. And so the idea that the United States could lead this massive continental scale amphibious operation of incredible complexity is incredibly diplomatically important for the United States. It also, though, is directly contrary to Britain's interests. Britain has, you know, zero interest in enhancing the United States' posture as a global competitor. But just as importantly, they have no interest in dragging all of the resources that they at that time were dedicating in Italy and hoping to use to essentially cut the Soviets' access to the Eastern Mediterranean off and to expand British influence in the Mediterranean. The British had no interest in forfeiting all of those resources to go further west into France. And so the debate over Operation Anvil, which is the southern France portion of the initial operation, becomes this just fierce, utterly exhausting debate over resources, and primarily landing craft, and primarily the landing ship tanker LSTs, which are the most important landing craft that the Allies can deploy in these amphibious operations. And it goes day after day after day, week after week, month after month of delicate negotiations, almost like, you know, trying to buy a used car, where little tiny, you know, incremental changes in the number of LSTs being allocated to one operation or the other are being had. And Eisenhower is essentially at the center of those negotiations, trying to get what he needs to launch Operation Overlord, as well as Operation Anvil, but sort of stuck between these two, you know, diametrically opposed visions of how not only the rest of the war should go, but how power should be projected in, you know, the Western Hemisphere between the British and the Americans. And, you know, I think anyone who's ever watched a divorce and watched, you know, two spouses fighting over, you know, flatware and silverware and who gets what, who gets the dog, know that, you know, it's not about the plates and the forks. It's about something deeper, and very much this almost interminable debate, which comes to be called the Battle of the Numbers, over landing craft, that Eisenhower is stuck in the middle of, is demonstrative of this shift in power in the world, and how at any given moment, what could be a cooperative and had been sort of one of the most intensely cooperative relationships between two large powers, probably in human history to that point, could at any given moment splinter off into direct competition.
To add flatware, they argued over double bunking on the LSTs, and then they argued over how many times the LST could make the trip from Britain to France before it needed servicing. It was that petty. But one more person at the table, even if he's not always there, Winston Churchill.
He's always there, definitely. If not in presence, in spirit. Yeah, Winston Churchill is obviously, as every you know, listener would know, you know, one of the more fascinating and charismatic and colorful figures of this period. And he is both a constant source of encouragement, help, and frustration for Eisenhower. And that relationship, to me, was one of the more, you know, not only fascinating, but really entertaining relationships to see, both because, you know, Churchill is such a strong personality and can really own a room, even when the king is in it. But also you can see, and Eisenhower actually reflects on this towards the end of his own life in the late 1960s in some just private writing that was never published, on how much of a mentor Churchill was to Eisenhower as Eisenhower is going from being this, again, important but, and, you know, well-liked but ultimately peripheral military figure to being a, you know, a full-blown world leader. And how much Eisenhower learns from Churchill just in this short period, in terms of thinking about politics, how to use power, is really one of the more, again, not only interesting, but hopefully actually fascinating and entertaining aspects of this whole period.
Note that you quoted FDR early when he's with Eisenhower in North Africa. That looks to be a quote that Eisenhower would always have in his mind when Winston acts up. Winnie is what President Roosevelt called him. Poor old Winnie, poor dear old Winnie, is getting pretty difficult. But Uncle Joe and I see eye to eye. That's just wonderful revelation. FDR believed he could charm Joseph Stalin all the way through to the end of the war, to his death, and saw Winston Churchill as playing fast and loose with the Soviets and with war planning. Churchill was afraid of one thing in his life, and that was Gallipoli. And it colored all of his decision-making, and you evidence that again and again, Michelle. Nothing more explains the fascination with Italy and southern France than Churchill imagined another Belgium, another trench warfare in the north being bogged down. And Eisenhower never really convinced him otherwise. Churchill, I imagine Churchill having that fear right up to the day of, because he wanted to be there. He wanted to take the risk. If they were going to die, I'm going to die with them. Did Eisenhower, we just have a minute here before we go on to the air plan. Did Eisenhower try to calm Churchill? Did he speak to him, or did he just let him blast away?
He tried all. Yeah, he tried all the time. You know, he felt it got to the point, and this is again something Eisenhower reveals in some of his private writing late in his life, that he would have the same conversation with Churchill over and over again, where Churchill would make the same very poetic sort of announce his very poetic fears of, you know, the channel tides running red with blood. And Eisenhower would, you know, reassure him, no, we have everything in place. I promise we will take Paris. And Churchill saying, if you take Paris by Christmas, this will be the greatest, you will be the greatest general in all of human history. There is this
30 seconds, Michelle, go ahead.
Yeah. And so they just had this, you know, incredible, incredibly intimate relationship, in fact. And Eisenhower did what he could up through the day of the invasion itself to reassure Churchill. And Churchill, you know, never really fully let go of his fears. And I think part of that was genuine, right? He really, really was haunted by Gallipoli and its tragedy. But it was also political. And at one point, he even admits to Eisenhower that, you know, I wouldn't want history to record that I had no doubts. Because not only was Gallipoli a disaster for the British Army, it had been a disaster for Winston Churchill's political career.
The light of battle, Michel Paradis. We're headed to D-Day. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Bash.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.